So we are talking about the kingdom of heaven, and we've kind of laid the groundwork on what God's plan is overall, what his purpose was in creation, and what happened when Satan brought sin into the world, what effect that had on God's purpose for man, for the kingdom. And we really began talking about a little bit kind of a parenthetical, a little bit of an aside, not an aside in that it's not talking about kingdoms, but an aside in that it's not talking about in particular biblical kingdoms. What I'm trying to accomplish with this lesson is to kind of get us to start thinking about kingdoms and what kingdoms are and how they operate. Because what's going to happen is that's then going to translate into God's kingdom. And so I'm trying to get us to really start thinking about and concentrating on the kingdom. And in particular, we talked about on Sunday morning, what is a kingdom? Just in general, what is a kingdom? And we talked about it being a territory. It's actually a territory with boundaries. Now, those boundaries may be physical. Those boundaries may be not so physical. We'll talk about that in a little bit more in just a minute. And then I ask, what does it mean to govern or to rule a kingdom? So we have a territory, we have an area that has some type of boundaries that's ruled. And what does it mean to rule a kingdom or to govern a kingdom? It makes laws, right? That's what the king does. The king in the kingdom governs it. All countries are governed in some way. And the reason that countries are governed is because that is how society is managed. Because laws are put in place by whoever's doing the governing to kind of deal with society and to have an orderly society. And then I ask, what does it mean to be a subject in a kingdom? And I mentioned that I use the word subject on purpose. A lot of times we talk about being a citizen of a kingdom. And if I say citizen, what comes to your mind?
Democracy.
A democracy? What else? What do we think of citizens have?
Freedoms.
And what else? Rights. And so and I'm not saying that's not the proper word. I'm just saying a lot of times in our society, in our culture, when we hear the word citizen, we automatically think about ourselves and our country. And so we think about, well, citizens have rights and citizens have freedoms and citizens have whatever. So whenever we're talking about kingdoms, the word citizen in that context does not work. Why does it not work? Because people in a kingdom are subjects. So what is a subject?
Under
the authority of someone else. It is a subject. And sometimes the word servant or slave is used. But in talking about kingdoms, I want us to think about subjects. Being under the authority and the rule of a king. So what does it mean to be under the authority of a rule of a king? It means that the subjects who are in that kingdom serve at the will of the king. So if the king says, go do this, the subject goes and does that. Why? Because the king has the authority to tell that subject what to do. We talked about the accountability that goes along with governing and with those laws. So the king tells the subject to go do something and the subject does not do that. Is that okay? Not in a kingdom. Because why? There's accountability that goes along with being in a kingdom. There's accountability that goes along with the law that's established by the king. That's true whether it's a kingdom, whether it's a democracy, Whoever is governed, that's laid down the laws, there's accountability that goes along with those laws. It doesn't matter what form of government it's in. As long as there are laws, there has to be accountability to those laws. Otherwise, there is no law. Let me say that again. If there's no accountability, there is no law. What makes the law, what gives the law strength is the accountability to it. So you can make a law, but if there's no accountability to it, there really is no law. So the king has the ultimate authority in the kingdom to lay out the laws, to lay out the punishment that goes along with those laws, and then to determine who those laws apply to. A king has the right to make laws who only apply to a certain group of people within his kingdom. So he can make laws that applies to this side of the building and make another law that applies to this side of the building. And he's perfectly right in doing that because he has the authority and the power to be able to do that. So we know what a kingdom is, we know what governing is, we know what subjects are, and we know what part accountability plays in the kingdom. So those are just general things. Now let's look at Daniel 2. I ask a question. What kingdoms are listed in Daniel 2, 37 through 43? Now if you hear John's class with the little ones on Sunday afternoons, you should know this by heart. Verse 37, chapter 2 of Daniel. You, O king, are the king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So what he's doing, he's giving the interpretation of the vision that who had had? Nebuchadnezzar. And so he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar and giving him the interpretation of it. And so he said, you are this head of gold. But after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. So did you see any kingdoms called out in those verses? There are descriptions of kingdoms, but are there any named kingdoms in those verses? So how do you answer the question, what kingdoms are listed in Daniel 2, 37 through 43? What's the first kingdom? Babylon. How do we know? Who's he talking to? Nebuchadnezzar. What king, what kingdom was Nebuchadnezzar over? Babylon. How do we know that? How do we know that? History tells us that, right? History tells us that. So what's the next kingdom? Medes and the Persians. How do we know that? History tells us. What's the next one? Greece. The Greek kingdom. How do we know that? History tells us. What's the next kingdom? The Romans. How do we know that? John's been going over that with the kids up here. History tells us. So how could Daniel tell about these four kingdoms? How does he know there was going to be four? From the revelation of God. So what does that have to do with what we're talking about? Here are examples of kingdoms. Great kingdoms. Powerful kingdoms. The next question is, why are there multiple kingdoms listed in these verses in Daniel 2? Why are there multiple ones listed? Why is there not just one? Why don't they? In case you didn't hear what he said, they don't last forever. Why don't kingdoms last forever? They're overthrown. God's in charge. So there are multiple kingdoms because those kingdoms don't last. Even though these kingdoms were world kingdoms, powerful kingdoms, they didn't last. Because what happens? Other kingdoms come in and overthrow them and take over. One of the purposes, and I mentioned these being great kingdoms, one of the purposes of having a huge kingdom, well, there's really two. One purpose is the bigger your kingdom, the more people that you rule over, that you have subject, and the greater army you can raise. So the more people you rule over, the bigger the army you can raise. Why would that be important? Because during these times when they went to war, who usually won? The one with the most people. Now why is that? Because generally it was hand-to-hand kind of combat. And so usually it was the one with the most people was the one who won. So you wanted to have a great kingdom, partly so you could raise a great army to try to keep your kingdom continued. Another reason was, whenever you have all these people, you can raise more taxes. You can raise more taxes because the king has to be supported, right? And all his people have to be supported. And so the bigger your kingdom is, the more people you have in your surroundings, your group of people. So the bigger the kingdom you have, the more people you have, the more taxes you can raise. Remember what it was that happened to Israel. Whenever they were a kingdom and they became divided, what was it that prompted that division? Too much taxes. So kings do that. They raise taxes. So the bigger the kingdom, the bigger the army you can raise, the more taxes you can raise. But keep in mind, those kingdoms only last for an amount of time. And there's always somebody else who comes along and takes them over. So you may be the subject of King Nebuchadnezzar this year, and you may be the subject of whoever the king was of the Medes and Persians the next year. And so the rules may change. And so your life may change. Your taxes may be increased or decreased or however, because you serve at the whim of the king. So, that's right. That's right. And we're coming to that. We're coming to that. So in the phrase kingdom of heaven, what does of heaven mean? In John 18 and verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Who's he talking to? Who is Jesus talking to in this passage? He's talking to Pilate. And so we looked at a verse a class or two ago where Pilate asked him, "Are you a king?" And his answer was, "I am a king. That's why I came in." I'm paraphrasing. "That's why I came into this world. That was my purpose." Well, now he says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. So my question is, in the phrase kingdom of heaven, what does of heaven mean? It's not of this world. It is of heaven. That's what Jesus is saying here. Then my kingdom's not of this world. The kingdom that we're talking about, or going to be talking about, the kingdom that we're in is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom that comes from heaven. How does it come from heaven? Was established by God. How else does it come from heaven? The throne's there. That's where Christ is. It is spiritual and not physical. All those things describe the fact that it is of heaven. Not only does it come from heaven, but it belongs to heaven. So not only is its origin in heaven, but because of its origin, it belongs to heaven. So we're going to talk about, because it belongs to heaven and because it comes from heaven, what does that entail? How does that make this kingdom different from the kingdoms we've been looking at? Those earthly kingdoms. That's right. So since this is my material, I have the prerogative of rearranging things. And so that's what I did on this one. This is actually the second part of the next lesson. So that is, what do we learn about the kingdom from these prophecies? So what is a prophet? A spokesman for God, right? And what is he speaking for God? Whatever God tells him. And so what is the prophecy? The prophecy is a message from God through the prophet. So I ask, what do we learn about the kingdom from these prophecies? Now I'm going to go through these, and my intent is really not to focus on the prophecies themselves, because these are very familiar prophecies, very familiar scriptures. But after we go through them and I point out just a couple of things, I want to talk about how they fit in with God's purpose. So the first one, Daniel 2:44. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. There's your first clue. There's a difference. Shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, and it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Isaiah 2:2. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days, that's telling us when, in the latter days, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So there's where it's going to start from. Ezekiel 37:21. Then say to them, thus says the Lord God, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, wherever they have gone, and will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all. They shall no longer be two nations, nor shall they ever be divided into two kingdoms again. They shall not defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. But I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I will be their God. David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. So we're going to be cleansed in the kingdom. Daniel 7, verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. They brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one that shall not be destroyed. And in verse 27, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Joel 2, verse 28, and it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also on my men servants and on my maid servants I will pour out my spirit in those days, and I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be deliverance, as the Lord has said, among the remnant whom the Lord calls. So when is that prophecy fulfilled? Day of Pentecost. Peter's sermon. Peter refers to this prophecy and he says, this is that which. So those are prophecies. Like I said, they're familiar prophecies. So I want to look at this for just a minute. So Joel, the last one that we just did, according to what I could find, was prophesying somewhere in the neighborhood of 850 B.C. What does B.C. mean? Before Christ. So he was prophesying roughly 850 years before Christ. So let that sink in for a second. And it is in Peter's sermon at Pentecost, or the day of Pentecost, when he preached that sermon, that he referred to this prophecy and said, this is the fulfillment of this prophecy in your eyes, basically. So who was Joel talking to in Joel 2? The children of Israel. He was talking to the people he was prophesying to or writing to. But contained within that is this prophecy that was fulfilled in Peter's sermon. So how could Joel know what God was going to do in the first century A.D.? Only if God told him. So 850 years before Christ, Joel said this. Peter said, this is the fulfillment of this prophecy. Isaiah, 750 years before Christ, roughly 100 years later, is prophesying. Micah, 725 B.C., Ezekiel 600 B.C., roughly 150 years after Isaiah. Daniel was carried away into captivity somewhere around 605, 606 B.C. His prophecy somewhere around 550, 575, somewhere in that neighborhood. What's the point? What am I trying to show you? We talked about God's plan was he had it before the beginning of the foundation, before the ages began. So what's been happening with Micah and Joel and Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel? They are laying out God's plan. Over how many years are these prophecies? And this is, if you really want to get into the prophecies, Foy Wallace has a book that's probably that thick that contains just prophecies. And you, in other words, we could spend a year just talking about prophecy because this is just a few. But the point is, from 850 to 575, that's nearly 300 years, God's laying out his plan. Laying out, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to establish a kingdom that's going to be forever. It's going to be ruled by a king who has dominion and authority and power. And that kingdom is going to stand, and the people who are going to be in it are going to be saved. Their sins are going to be forgiven. All those things God's laying out all these years before the kingdom actually comes in. Now, why is he doing that? What was the problem? What was the problem with the Jews and Christ in the first century? The problem was the Jews were looking for a kingdom. Where did they get the idea that there was going to be a kingdom, that God was going to establish a kingdom? From the prophecies. So the Jews were looking at the prophecies and they were expecting a kingdom to be established. The problem was they were looking for the wrong kind of kingdom. So when Christ came, they could see that Christ was the fulfillment of a lot of the prophecies. And so they recognized that he could be the king, the one they had been waiting for all this time. Where did they get the idea of what the Messiah was going to be like? From the prophecies. Because God was laying it out over all these years. Here's what this kingdom's going to be like. Here's what you're looking for. Here's the kind of person that's going to be the Messiah. Why is he doing that? So they will know. So that they can be a part of the kingdom. They didn't have to. No. No. That's right. But the purpose of doing this was so that the people in the first century, when it came about, could recognize it and know it and be a part of it. That was the purpose. And what's even more amazing, it was written down. It was written down. Why is that amazing? Because it's easy to pass those on. So that people can read and study and understand what God's plan, what God's purpose is. It is still his purpose. But the purpose of the prophecies was to lay it out so that whenever it came to be, people could recognize it and know it and become a part of it. How much more could he do to say to us, I want you to be in the kingdom? We have a tremendous advantage where we are today, even compared to those in the first century. Because we can look back at all this and see history, how history has played out, those four kingdoms that we talked about. And we can look back and see how Christ fulfilled those prophecies. And we can look back and see how the kingdom fulfills all those prophecies. With that great knowledge comes great responsibility. Comes great responsibility. Because not only can we know it, and not only do we know it, but we also have a responsibility to make sure others have an opportunity to know it and to be a part of it. And that's a tremendous responsibility. But keep in mind, God's purpose is to have that kingdom. to have those, to have that group of people with him in heaven, and look at all that he's doing to make that happen. To make that happen. Questions, comments before we're about out, and I want to go one more thing. That's right. Right. And all those things, the you know, God's kingdom is the opposite of all those earthly kingdoms that we talked about. The nature of those earthly kingdoms and the nature of God's kingdom is so different. It is opposite. And we're going to talk about that as we go through the next little while.
When you think about it, the best form of government really is an absolute benevolent monarchy. But the reason that never worked on earth is because even if you got a good king, what usually tended to happen, they would eventually die, and eventually somebody didn't raise their son right, and then you had a bad king take over, and then it's all for naught. But literally, we don't have to worry about that for eternal spiritual.
They would die, or they would be conquered. But they were always temporary, no matter, and that's proven with Israel over and over and over. They had good kings and they had bad kings, and God would bless them and God would bring them down and humble them, and based on the king and how they reacted and whether they were following God's word or not following his word. Absolutely. And one of the great proofs of God are the prophecies. That's one of the great proofs. You know, we've talked about heaven and we've talked about the creation and that being proof of God. This is also proof of God, or the prophecies. And in particular, you know, whenever I think about that, I think about the prophecy of Cyrus being the king who would allow them to go back. You know, I mean, he was named specifically. And it was, if I remember right, about 150 years or so before it actually took place, that he would allow them to go back. So it's just amazing, just amazing. Okay, I think I'm going to stop right there, and this will probably be a good place to stop. And we're going to have a guest teacher on Sunday. And Wednesday, and we'll pick back up. So what I'll do whenever we come back on the next Sunday is I'll go through some of the things that we've already talked about, just to kind of refresh us and get our minds going back. But we're going to really get into also the nature of God's kingdom. That's what I've been trying to lay the groundwork for, is how God's kingdom is so different from the kingdoms of the world, and yet they're similar. And yet they're similar. We'll talk about that next time. Appreciate your comments.